Oh, hey gang, Kevin Strange here.
Jeremy Daniels.
And we're here to talk about April's Patreon bullshit. Right now, you can get Cotton Candy in full, my infamous weird sex novella in full right now at Patreon for only $1 ad-free in its entirety, an hour and a half long audiobook right now.
Of gangbang sweetness.
Of gangbang sweetness. You can also get Jorek and the Swamp Phantoms of Ik in full, commercial free. Make humans. Jorek and the Shoggoth steal.
Humans Under the Bed.
And you can get Humans Under the Bed. All right now. For $1. You can listen. You can literally pay $1 and download all of those audiobooks to your hard drive. For just $1 on patreon.com/KevinTheStrange. Gang, get on that shit.
Boop. Hey, Kevin. What do you want to do about this podcast intro?
For reading to strangers?
Yeah.
I was thinking we'd download this broody-ass music, like, blah, 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 and then you'd be like, read to strangers. I'd be like, I don't want to read to strangers. I'd be like, read to strangers. I'd be like, I don't want to read to strangers. Then I shoot myself in the head. Pow!
See, I was thinking more like Reading Rainbow's theme song.
Like, with LeVar Burton?
Yeah.
Like, take a look, it's in a book, that shit?
Yeah, but like, reading to strangers.
Reading to strangers. Reading to strangers. No, that's a terrible idea. Hell, we're back.
We got it back
for another episode of Reading to Strangers.
Reading to Strangers.
Reading to Strangers. We haven't done that in a while.
I know.
What is this, episode 14?
Something like that.
Getting close.
Yep.
Dangerously close to that 20 mark.
I think the king size bed sharing it may be the end of us. Can't go back to friends after you cross that barrier.
Do you want to go right into the news then?
Sure.
We are officially, we have bought the table for Crypticon Kansas City.
KCMO.
2017. Oh. We are going to be in Kansas City July 14th through the 17th.
Nope.
2017. That'll be our second show of the year, but that's like 3 months, man. 3.5 months. Mm-hmm. What is it? April, May, June, July. 3.5 months. I don't like that we're waiting 3.5 months to do another show. So,
well, the next big one we were going to do, I'm going to be in Jamaica. So
I have, and they contacted me also. Days of the Dead. They wanted me to do their show also, but I think that I just don't have the fundage right now to go all in on these tables, because I really want to do Flashback in August.
Yeah.
And then Horror Hound again in September. So we're going to do July, August, September. So that'll give us enough time. This 3.5 months will give us enough time to come up with the funds to pay for all those tables and do that run of bam, 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 three in a row each month like that. And let me tell you something, man. There's been a nice bump in podcast downloads and in sales from the show.
Which is awesome. So, thank everybody if you're listening.
Yeah, for all the new listeners, man, we're glad you're here. We hope you're digging what you're hearing. Hope you're going back and listening to the previous episodes. You know, one thing about this show that I realized, like looking at it on the podcast apps and stuff, it's really hard to see what readings we're doing on any particular week. Like sometimes I'll call it like the Jorek finale and stuff like that, but I think I may need to start labeling them differently so that when you just go down through the list, you see, for instance, this month it's gangbang month.
Yes, it is. April it is.
April is gangbang month in Strangeville.
Yep.
And we're starting the reading for my weird sex novella.
Trying to bring May flowers with golden showers.
May flowers with golden showers. You heard it here first from Jeremy Daniels. So with Cotton Candy, I would want to label, you know, Cotton Candy episode 1, 2, 3, however many there are going to be of it.
Well, maybe we'll just do the name of the book, or the name of the reading, colon, what we would normally name it anyway, so.
I don't know. Because I like, there was only two likes.
Yes.
I didn't triple like. I like to give each episode...
Four likes.
I like to give each episode the, No, that's know what I'm saying. Is like the know what I'm saying a strange?
It is right now.
I like to have the episodes have their own personality. You know, each episode has its own name, like its own title.
But at the same time, put it in parentheses at the end.
Think in parentheses, but then those titles end up being super long. I don't know.
Can't have your cake and eat it too, man.
Yeah, I have to figure this out. I haven't figured it out yet.
Maybe we could abbreviate it, CC. One,
something like that.
We'll figure something out.
Something. So, yeah, for all the new listeners, I mean, we've gotten hundreds of downloads since we got back from the show.
That's awesome.
So there's a lot of new listeners, and I'm always skeptical. You know, I busted my ass to make up all those flyers, paid, you know, good money, take 1,000 flyers to the show. And I'm always just like, I mean, I think I even made you a bet, like, because there was a trash can nearby.
Yeah.
I was like, how many of these motherfuckers are going to be like, thanks so much, and then drop the fucking flyer in the trash can. But I didn't see any.
Yeah, I didn't see a single one either.
In fact, you remember that weird little kid? There was a little kid that went, like, broke off from his family, scrambled under the table, grabbed a flyer he saw under the table, yeah. Ran back, and put it in his dad's bag. I
almost forgot about that kid.
I was like, what just, did that
couldn't
kid
figure
just...
out why he was running up, and he slid under the table, and I was like, what the hell? And then he came up with a flyer and snuck it in dad's bag when he wasn't looking.
So. I was like, what just fucking happened? Did he just... Strange Bomb Dad with Strangeville advertising. That's, I mean.
And we also forgot last week to talk about Rape Cop.
Rape Cop. Go ahead.
Yeah, a guy came up and he had a Lucifer, nice shirt, but a big Lucifer symbol on the back, which is nothing too crazy.
Not at a horror con.
No,
you
no, no.
You see lots of satanic imagery at a horror
con. And, you know, but this is an attractive lady and, started chit-chatting him up, and I don't remember.
We were telling him about the books, and he got to Inside an Asshole, and was like, honey, look at this one.
Yes.
And she looked at it, read the title, and goes, uh-uh. And he's like, looks at us, and he goes, not yet. And she goes, uh-uh. And he goes, how did he put it after that?
It's not rape if they're unconscious.
And then right as, and we're like, uh-huh. And then right as he goes to walk off, he turns back and goes, I'm a cop, so I know.
Whoa! Rape cop!
And it was just, I mean, he looked like a, you know, a guy that didn't fit in, except for his Lucifer shirt.
Yeah, he was very much a straight-laced looking fella.
Yeah. So, yeah, rape cop. So,
and he is a rape cop. So, and his lady seemed none too thrilled that she was going to be...
But she wasn't really thrilled later that night if he was sedating and... hammering home, so to speak.
So there's that. So Kansas City, happy about that.
Yeah.
Excited about it.
Yeah.
But the 3.5 months, so I'm going to make a vow. I don't know if I'll be able to keep this vow, but I'm going to try. There's literally nothing we can do in the next 3 months except get ready for the next show. Continue to record podcasts. And right.
I was going to say, there's a lot we got to do. We're going to do computer phase.
Well, we're going to do we're going to do readings, and we're going to get audiobooks ready, and we're going to keep doing podcasts. But I'm going to make a public vow right now to write 3 books in the next 3 months. They're not going to be out for this show. I'm not saying I'm going to have 3 new books ready for this show, but I'm saying April, May, and June, I'm going to try to complete a book in each of those 3 months in the lead up to the show. That's how I'm going to sort of, like, if I have to concede that I can't do another horror con for 3.5 months, then I want to be super productive in the 3 months leading up to it. I don't want to waste these 3 months. I want to get...
No, we're not going to waste it. I mean, we have 8 hours at least of recording for...
Yeah.
Because we're going to start doing bigger novels.
Yeah.
Or novellas, I guess it would be.
Yeah. Well, both. So. Computer Face is a novella, but then we're going to move on and do novels.
Yeah.
We'll do our first novel. And gang, you guys will get to hear a show for 6-8 weeks. It'll be the same book. Or for only $1 a month on Patreon.
Yeah, that's when that Patreon deal's gonna... I mean, if they start passing it up after that, I'll be shocked.
Yeah.
I mean, you're talking three months long, yeah. Right? And you can listen to it day one.
Yeah.
For $1.
Yeah. Yeah. So, something interesting happened. I'm trying to think of all the things I wanted to talk about. If I want to cover this right now, or if I want to hold off on it. Because I want the second half of this, after we come back, I want the second half of this episode to be the origin story of Cotton Candy, which is the origin story of the Strange Sex Anthology.
Okay.
But, you know, we always prattle on a bit before we get to the reading. And I did something interesting today. For the first time in 4 months, I logged into my Facebook page.
Oh my God, big news.
I had 50 messages.
Wow.
I logged in not
wait
because...
Wait a minute, hold on. 1 second, I gotta check this live on air. One second. Not good. You didn't like the fucking reading to strangers page.
I didn't do anything. I logged in specifically because there are female acquaintances of mine that I had lost contact with over the last 4 months because they haven't sent me any messages outside of Facebook, and these are the acquaintances that I don't have contact numbers for, that we've only talked through Facebook or...
So the only thing to get Kevin Strange back is the pussy.
Either we only ever talked through Messenger, or they've changed their phone numbers, and we haven't been in contact for 4 months. And there's a few of the ladies that I missed, and I wanted to let them know because I had a sneaking suspicion since stuff still posts all the time, all the stuff from my website,
KevinStrange.com
posts all the time. Whenever I post from Instagram, it goes to Twitter and Facebook, so my Facebook page still has a lot of activity. It's a one way street. I post content to Facebook. I do not see comments.
But it does, it does say at the top where it's posted
But nobody pays attention to that stuff. They just see Kevin Strange in their newsfeed, and they think I'm still
there. I know the haters didn't. Oh, I thought you weren't on. Read the top, you jackass.
So, and as I discovered, 50 unread messages, 200 friend requests, and hundreds of notifications that people still think I'm there. So I started to go through the messages, and sure enough, these ladies that I'd lost contact with had been trying to hold conversations with me
on Facebook. And they're probably pissed. Kevin Strange will come back.
And so the only reason I went there, I literally went there, clicked on the messages, went, oh, yep, there's her. So I sent a couple quick messages.
There's reading to strangers request.
Couple,
fuck that, dude.
Couple of quick messages. Hey, I'm off Facebook. Contact me. Here's my, you know, text me. Or email me, just letting you know. Boom, boom, boom. And then I saw a message from one of the Bizarros. And I had no intention. I'm sure there are dozens more from these motherfuckers. But I had no intention of getting into those, of getting into the drama, of arguing with anyone. But right up near the top, in between some of the ladies I wanted to, you know, let them know I wasn't going to be around Facebook anymore. There was one fella in particular that I had a great relationship with who had told me on more than one occasion over the course of years that if I ever got back into publishing, he wanted to publish a book. He wanted me to publish a book for him. He wanted me to be his publisher. That's the kind of friendship we had. He said, if you ever get back into publishing, bro, let me know. I want you to be the guy that publishes my book. And I always said, you know, thank you. Big respect. Really liked this guy. Had a lot of great conversations with this dude over the course of years. This isn't somebody I talked to a couple of times, right? Never met him, but I've had a friendship with this guy for years. And I see a message from him. And I was curious enough to say, which way did this dude go on this? Because he is a former Portland area cat. So I wonder which direction. I don't give a fuck what any of these people think, right? And one of the reasons I left Facebook was because I was tired of being yanked in a bunch of different directions, argued with, having people try to change the direction of my, you know, I would make a point and they would try to try to misconstrue it like they didn't understand it and drag me into some whole other debate when I was just trying to make one clear, concise point. And I got so tired of dealing with that. And you can go back and listen to the Why Kevin Strange Left Facebook episode for me, for a big, long articulation of all the reasons why I left. But curiosity got the best of me, and I clicked on this dude's message to see which side he fell on. Which side do you think he fell on?
Since I didn't hear about it beforehand, I would say that he probably didn't care.
Oh, he cared. He cared a lot. And there was this big, long diatribe from him where he was explaining to me that he has a friend who has been wrongly imprisoned and has been in prison for years for abusing, for being, he was convicted of abusing a woman he never abused. He was wrongly convicted, and he correlated that. This is my friend, and this is why it's so important to me. And since you talked about the airplane, you being me, since Kevin Strange talked about the airplane perpetrator on the air, I can go fuck myself forever. And he even used the words, you should be ashamed of yourself for doing podcasts like that. That's how he ended it. You should be ashamed of yourself. So I want to talk to this guy. This is an open letter right now on the podcast to this fella if he's listening. I am ashamed of myself. And I am sorry. Ashamed that I was ever friends with any of you fucking people. Sorry that I ever thought that there was any fucking point to having these years-long friendships with people that are so close-minded and so fucking dumb that they can't see. How many fucking hours did we do on Bizarro Gate, Jeremy? Hours and hours and hours.
And we were way more fair than I think that we even needed to be.
This had nothing to do with the airplane jerk-off. It had everything to do with how this community of writers treat their friends one way and everyone else another way. I have no love for the fucking penal system. It makes me sad that this guy has a friend that was wrongly convicted. I'm sitting next to a guy that was wrongly accused of shit. The fucking Bizarro Gate had nothing to do with being a witch hunter and trying to publicly shame someone. It was showing the hypocrisy of public shaming. We were trying to show them that they will be held to their standards, and the next time they try to publicly shame someone and out someone for nonsense, that guys like us are going to be there to hold them accountable for their own fucking standards, and that those standards should end. How many hours did we do on this? 3-4 hours sat here in front of this microphone and said, stop public shaming. Stop witch hunting authors. Authors' sex lives have nothing to do with their writing careers. Publicly assassinating the careers of writers is fucking morally reprehensible. And this guy's sitting here telling me I should be ashamed of myself for pointing out the hypocrisy because that guy happens to be his friend.
We went out of our way to try to be as fair as humanly possible in that situation.
But airplane perpetrator is their friend.
Therefore, just goes to show they didn't listen to our fucking podcast.
That's what I think. When I read that, you should be ashamed of yourself for doing podcasts like this. All I could think of was, motherfucker, you didn't even listen.
Yeah.
You didn't even listen.
He listened to somebody who listened.
He heard from somebody else that I went after his friend, and I should be ashamed of myself for going
because
after his friend.
Went after.
Let me
our game.
Let me clarify one more time.
We would have blown some boats up other than that boat.
The Bizarro Gate controversy was about a subject that was in the middle of going viral on social media. We were commentating on an issue that had already been blown open.
And especially you. If you'd have listened, you were a little more forgiving. Now, I have my own issues, and I, looking at all the facts, judged it a different way than you. You were more neutral that this shouldn't go on. I actually had a solid opinion on that author / editor.
My opinion is it doesn't fucking matter.
No, but
he's not a fucking grade school teacher.
Exactly.
He's a fucking Bizarro writer. It doesn't matter what he does in his personal
life. But we went out of our way, you with the neutral opinion, me with a slightly jaded one-way opinion. Went out of our way to keep the focus off of that. Yeah, we exposed, I guess, that.
No, we didn't expose it. We read verbatim from a website that had gone viral, that was all over social media, that his friends were actively trying to suppress. That his friends were actively trying to delete from every Facebook page they could. This stuff. How many people sent us this stuff? We had this fucking link to this webpage coming from us from 6 or 7 different sources, all asking us, are you going to talk about this? Are you going to talk about this? Are you going to talk about this? Because for months I had been saying, put an end to public shaming. Put an end to public shaming. Pointing at that community going, you people go after everyone's sex life. You go after everyone's sex life and you try to publicly shame them. And from 6, 7 different sources, we had people going, well, they didn't do that with him. Look, they're covering up for this guy. They're covering up for this guy.
We waited two weeks for a guy to cover it that publicly outed you as a protector of these people because you had an opinion that maybe we should...
After it had gone viral, we waited an additional 2 weeks to even talk about it, to even talk about it once. It was fucking everywhere. It was all over. If you were in the writing community, you already fucking knew about this thing.
Yeah.
And these people want to tell me that I should be ashamed of myself. If I should be ashamed of myself for holding them to their own fucking standards and calling them a bunch of fucking hypocrites for covering up for their own friends when they go after people for much, much less than that guy was accused of, then shame on me. Shame on fucking me for ever bothering to ever fuck with that community in the fucking first place. I should have gone the same route I went with filmmaking. Filmmaking, when I started making movies, I said, I'm not going to fucking fuck anybody else making movies. It's me. It's my crew. We make movies. We take them out. We put them in front of the fucking fans. And that's it. Us and the fans. What did I do for 6 fucking years but jerk this fucking writing community off that led to a couple of nominations for an award and that's it? What the fuck else happened?
Except I'm not going to go that far. You did meet a few people that are still with you. I mean, that's evident in the book sales. That's evident in the podcast.
No, that's us creating art and taking it directly to the fucking fans.
Well, yeah, but
exactly what I did.
I'm not going to say there may be 3 or 4 people. I know there was one at the last convention that you met during that time period. So there may be a few if you're listening. We're not throwing you under the bus with it, but the majority of the people that try to get next to you or get published by you or try to say that they're your friend. Basically, are a bunch of trash. Just fucking turned their back on you as soon as you had a different opinion than the cool kids.
I've been reading this fucking fantastic book from the legendary Jim Goad about called The New Church Ladies.
Yeah, I saw that.
And one of it, oh my God, it's the best. It's a fucking 200-page rant on social justice warriors, on progressive leftists, on the politically correct culture. It is glorious. And there's a whole chapter on progressives being open-minded and accepting of everyone and all about equality until you have a different opinion than them.
And then they are the most
totalitarian, fucking, just elitist fucking scumbags, close-minded scumbags you will ever fucking come across.
We were just talking about it last night. Unless it goes against something that the other side is saying.
Yeah.
If the right side, the whole, Donald Trump, immigrants, rapists, as soon as it may cross streams with that, they attack innocent girls' text messages.
Right.
The victims' text messages.
Right. And you're talking about a case where a couple of immigrants allegedly raped a middle school or high school girl. Anyway, yeah, Jeremy was sending me text last night about a news story about social justice warriors going after the victim in the case.
CNN article.
instead of going after the rapists, because the alleged rapists were immigrants and they're higher on the repressed stack than females.
Well, it was all because the right was saying, look,
right.
He was right. You said he was a liar, he was right. Yep. And then so they attacked a under 16-year-old girl for getting gang raped in a bathroom.
Well, it is gangbang month, so let's segue right into my the first part of my weird sex novella, Cotton Candy.
The first story we recorded together.
This is the first story we recorded together. This was the first officially published Kevin Strange story.
Wow.
This, the anthology Strange Sex, came out before Robo Apocalypse, which was my first solo work. So this was the first officially available. I had a couple of little chat books that I made up in-house and took to conventions. That doesn't count. Those were DIY. This was the first official Kevin Strange product you could buy from Amazon. And we are airing it to you now. Part one, read by me, engineered. This was actually edited by you, wasn't it?
Yep.
It's edited by Jeremy Daniels. Fucking read by me in a weird voice. Yeah, we'll talk about that.
That's great.
We'll talk
that's
about
great.
That on the other side. So without further ado, we're going to quit fucking with you. Here's Cotton Candy Part 1, and come back after the...
Cotton Candy! Yeah.
Come back after the reading to hear about the origin of Cotton Candy and the Strange Sex Anthology. We'll see you after the jump, gang. Peace out. What's up, you reader fucks? My name's Kevin Strange.
And this is Travis.
And we're here from the Watching with Strangers podcast, because there's other things in the world besides books, too, you bookish fucks. We review cult movies. What kind of cult movies do we review, Travis?
All kinds of cult movies.
Like what?
Cultists of the cult, including Cult from the Future.
Cult movies from the future at kevinthestrange.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes, Stitcher, and wherever other podcasts fuck, you fucks. Seneca pulled the teddy bear head down over her face. It felt surprisingly heavy and thick, almost like a real fur hat would feel. But this one was bright purple with faux hair, a day-glow pink nose, and coloring along the inside of the ears. Catcalls followed as she posed and preened, giggling. "Slut!" one girl yelled. "Work that little ass!" another said. She'd received the strange text earlier that afternoon. Her literature professor at Clawson and Sampson Junior College for Girls had sent out a mass text to her entire class that asked them all to meet him in their classroom at 8 p.m. sharp. As if this text wasn't odd enough, coming from her teacher on a Saturday night, Mr. Pillinghast had been on a personal leave of absence for the past 2 months after the sudden death of his wife. Weirder still, when the girls showed up at 8, Mr. P was nowhere to be found. The door to the classroom, however, was unlocked. Seneca and several others had let themselves in, only to find the room empty. What they found inside proved to be strangest of all. Strewn about the room were dozens and dozens of little plushy stuffed animals, in the chairs, atop the desks, lying on the floor. The various kittens, puppies, birdies, reptiles, and assorted farm animals looked as though they'd been haphazardly tossed into the room with haste. But even more bizarre, laying across Mr. P's desk were a dozen life-sized, day-glow-colored, plushy animal costumes, complete with oversized heads that fit in such a way as to leave the person's head sticking out of the animal's mouth as though they'd been swallowed whole, with only their face remaining visible within the animal's open maw. Along with the heads came matching full-body costumes, paw booties, and gloves. The girls had squealed and fought over the outfits, but Seneca managed to get a hold of the big purple teddy bear before anyone else. Purple was her favorite color, and she still had a huge collection of plushy teddy bears at home from when she was a kid. Monica, Seneca's best friend, put on a pink fuzzy cat head. It had pointy ears and big cute googly eyes that shook every time Monica shook her head. The remaining girls, 10 in all, grabbed up the rest of the costumes consisting of bunnies, birds, puppies, mice, and various other cute, plushy animals.
"I wonder what Mr. P wants to talk to us about,"
Jamie, a preppy cheerleader with long auburn hair, said to Seneca once the group had settled down.
"I don't know, but I hope it's to tell us he's coming back,"
Seneca said, sniffing the purple paw on her right hand. It had a faint, sweet smell that she couldn't quite place.
"Fuck that,"
said Kelly, a punkish girl with a mohawk of long black dreadlocks that hung back in a ponytail. The sides of her head were shaved and tattooed. She was the best poetry writer in the class, but her poems were always morbid and way too sexual for Seneca.
"Mr. Humongous is a way better teacher."
His name wasn't really Mr. Humongous. The girls called him that because he had an unmistakable huge bulge in the front of his trousers when he lectured the class.
"You're just saying that because you want to suck his big fat cock," Monica said, making lewd blowjob motions with her hand and tongue.
The others burst out in giggles. Kelly's face flushed red, but she did not deny the accusation. Instead, choosing to cover her embarrassed face with the big floppy ears from her puppy costume while she giggled uncontrollably.
"I hope he gets here soon. My boyfriend's coming over later," Amanda said. "Did anyone see his car in the parking lot?"
"Nope," Seneca said.
"Just a weird-ass rusted-out RV. Maybe Mr. P has been living off the land."
Amanda shuddered, visibly.
"He always did give me the creeper vibe." "Hey, what's this?"
another girl asked, after the laughter died down. This one wore a bright yellow tutu with a large poofy bird tail trailing out behind it, her tiny face almost hidden within the huge beak of her bird hat. She picked up a thick manuscript from the desk that had previously been covered by the costumes which the girls now wore. The cover read, simply, "Cotton Candy." Seneca snatched the manuscript from the other girl's hands. She plopped down in a chair next to the huge window overlooking the main campus gathering area below. In fact, the entire building, which housed the English department, was one big window. Some eco-friendly Greenpeace architect had designed it in such a way as to harness as many glass panels as possible in order to conserve electricity. Two walls and the entire ceiling of the classroom were windows from top to bottom, side to side. The moonlight was not quite high enough in the sky to illuminate the entire room, but there was enough for Seneca to comfortably see what she was reading. Monica and the other girls crowded around her, their curious questions filling the air.
"What is it? Who wrote it? What's it about?"
"Shut the fuck up,"
Seneca said, annoyed. She turned the page, scanned it, turned a few more, and then gasped.
"What?"
Monica whined, dying to be let in on Seneca's new little secret.
"It's written by Mr. P."
The girls started to giggle again.
"It's addressed to us."
The girl shrieked and tried to pull the manuscript from Seneca's hands.
"Back off," she said. "I'll fucking read it out loud, Jesus."
Seneca loved being the center of attention. She loved even more holding this kind of power over the other girls. Excited, she turned back to page one and started reading out loud. First, she read in a comical voice, imitating and exaggerating the uptight and impersonal academic tone of their professor. But soon enough, as the story became more and more bizarre, she dropped the mocking act and simply read the story for what it was. This is what she read.
"Girls, I apologize for the unorthodox method with which I've chosen to contact you after my unfortunate time away from the classroom. I assure you, there is absolute and sound reasoning for my calling on you this particular day at this particular time. But in order for you to fully understand this reasoning, you must understand what awful fate has so recently befallen your dear teacher. What follows is absolute truth. Of that fact, there is no question. This manuscript is a chronicling of the events of the past 2 months of my life, and I must warn you now, they are not for the weak of heart. The description of my ordeal will be raw and extremely graphic. I simply know of no other way to express into words the morbid, carnal, and bizarre parody that has become my life. Lest you misunderstand my intentions, though, let me reiterate the fact that I did not write this chronicle as a confession of sins, but rather as a simple distraction from ever-increasing and obsessive thoughts that I cannot bear to act upon. Thoughts which are still, even now, driving me slowly mad. Read further at your own risk." My first life ended with the sudden and unexpected death of my dearly beloved wife, Susanna. As some of you know, she and I were married for 43 years. Susanna was everything to me, my anchor, my conscience. She is the person who pushed me to pursue academia as a career. She made the decision for us to focus our lives on our careers rather than having children of our own. Our place, she often said, is to help the children already in this world. Enriching the lives of hundreds versus those of two or three biologically inclined.
was to her a humanitarian gesture of the highest order. That was Susanna, selfless, altruistic to a fault, always practical and calculating the best odds. It's no wonder she became a math teacher. The aneurysm took her from me swiftly and without pity. Only 10 minutes before, we'd texted about dinner. Then I got the phone call. Life is a merciless mistress. After the funeral, I was lost. It was weeks before I could even sleep in our bedroom, in our bed that we'd shared for 4 long decades. It did not, I'm ashamed to say, take that long before the itch started in the recesses of my subconscious mind. Susanna, for all her saintly qualities, unfortunately did not possess any semblance of a sex drive. I did not allow her frigidness to bother me. She was too good a woman to hold such a trivial thing against. I pleasured myself manually in the shower whenever the urge presented itself, which, in all honesty, it rarely ever did. That is, until Susanna died. When I said she was my anchor and conscience, I was not speaking merely in a romantic or metaphorical way. I felt an intense freedom after her passing, a freedom that scared me down to my deepest core. Susanna decided to become a vegetarian, so I became a vegetarian. Susanna loved classical music, so I filled my album collection with only the greatest composers. She was raised a strict Catholic, so I attended Mass twice weekly. Before she'd been in the ground 48 hours, I was eating cheeseburgers, listening to Dylan and Elvis as loudly as I wanted in my study, dancing and singing, eating awful food, drinking cheap whiskey. I was like a teenager again. I was the kid I'd been before Susanna came into my life. At 62 years old, I'd found the self I never knew I'd lost. That's when the itch started. That's when everything went horribly and irreversibly wrong. That's when my second life began. Susanna had frowned upon watching too much television, said it was lazy man's entertainment, that the intellectuals read books. I love books, but after she died, I could not concentrate on my reading. I couldn't keep my mind from racing back through gulfs of time spent with the most wonderful woman I'd ever met. I needed a distraction. I flipped through the channels, mindlessly at first, welcoming the droll hum of the television set in the study. Soon enough, I stopped on one of the cable channels. A suspense thriller was more than halfway into its murder, sex, lies, and stunning twist plot lines. I let my mind relax, gorged myself on someone else's drama. And then the blonde bombshell murderess seduced our grizzled detective lead. She ripped off her tiny dress, revealed her perfect breasts, and moaned in ecstasy as the hard-boiled cop took her from behind. At that moment, I came alive. The vague stirrings flamed up into a house fire of carnal lust. My cock went utterly rigid in my pants to the point of demonstrable pain. I had to unleash him. Words cannot describe my excitement as I took my flesh into my hand for the first time outside of the comfortable solitude of my shower in more than 40 years. I stroked as the cop thrust. I moaned as the blonde screamed in ecstasy. The three of us, we climaxed together in some weird, vicarious, late-night cable TV menage a trois. It was, without a doubt, the best orgasm of my life. I was lightheaded as I switched off the television. I scooted myself, pants around ankles, to the study couch and collapsed, falling fast asleep, still stewing in my own sticky juices. The next morning, I awoke, feeling refreshed, invigorated even, but more than anything else, horny as hell. I masturbated once before even leaving the couch. Again, after a morning piss, I masturbated through 7 phone calls from bereaved colleagues, family members, and close friends. Thank you for your condolences, fap, fap, fap. She was a great woman. She'll truly be missed, fap, fap, fap. I don't know what I'll do without her, fap, fap, fap. What I did was jack off every day, all day, until my penis was chafed, raw, and aching. I didn't put pants on again for an entire week, and only then with reluctance. I simply had become unsatisfied with cable TV sex. I craved more. I'd unleashed a beast within myself, and that beast was hungry. I'd never viewed pornography before. Not unless you count half-crumbled Playboy pictorials quietly passed around middle school playgrounds. I did, however, know where to purchase it. I don't own a personal computer, nor would I know how to operate the machine if I were to buy one. I remain deliciously old school in that regard. So the deluge of internet pornography remains outside of my grasp. Susanna, though, had chaired a church protest group that attempted to stop a sex toy and boutique shop called Hottest Topics from opening in our neighborhood. Her failure was my blessing. My sweet, obscene, pornographic blessing. My first trip into the store was terrifying. I was the only patron in the place, and yet, even with only one bored clerk reading a magazine behind the counter, I felt like the entire world was watching me, judging me. I passed the wall of enormous dildos and the racks of tiny lingerie toward the movie wall in the far corner. I was too embarrassed to even look fully at all of the naked bodies engaging in acts and positions I'd never even dreamed of. I quickly grabbed a movie from the shelf without even looking at the title, and I purchased it. I became even more embarrassed when I had to ask the clerk what kind of playback device I needed in order to play the offending film. He was extremely gracious and helpful, pointing out that I could buy a television set with built-in DVD player so I wouldn't have to mess with any sorts of wires or assemblies. I masturbated to the disc 32 times before deciding that a midget sleeping with obese women was probably not my thing, as it were. Over the next month, I purchased over 40 pornographic films, reveling in the carnal nasties and perverted lust, the clinically graphic visual stimulation in a way I'd never experienced anything before. Keep in mind, my excitement for the week normally consisted of completing the New York Times crossword puzzle. I was drunk on pornography, but soon mere masturbation was not enough. And herein, girls, lies my great folly, my descent into degradation, depravity, and ultimate humiliation, and in time, absolute terror. But I digress. Soon, Susanna's death was but a slight memory. I'd begun to purchase sex toys from the store, using them on myself as I tasted more and more of that forbidden fruit of my awakened sexuality. One day, I watched all oral compilation films, stuffing myself with images of fat cocks sliding in and out of plump female mouths, ultimately losing their seed on gorgeous faces and into eager mouths. Over 4 hours of beautiful women sucking the male root dry. As I did so, I pleasured myself with a rubber pocket sex toy shaped to resemble the human mouth. The next day, bondage films were the order of the day, while I wore a ball gag and nipple clamps, withholding orgasm after orgasm with tight cock rings designed to prolong my erections. I continued this way, barely eating, barely sleeping for days on end. I was binging on fleshy excess. I made my way through all available sexual fetish categories at the porn shop. All female, threesomes, all anal, bisexual, transsexual, pregnant women, fat women, old women, young women. I fucked myself retarded with all manner of pocket pussies, dildos, pocket assholes, butt plugs, cock rings, stingers, poppers. I cleaned out the porn shop. But it was not enough. It was never enough. The beast was insatiable. I purchased an escort, made love to her in all of the newfound positions and creative motions that pornography had so recently taught me, right there in Susanna's house, before the dirt on her grave had yet to even settle. Then I bought two, fucking them both in the bed I'd shared with my beloved for more years than I had not. One pissed in my mouth, while the other shit on my plastic wrap-covered chest in the very spot Susanna had kneeled to pray for the entirety of her adult life. Still, it wasn't enough. Never enough! The beast needed more. I'd become a sexual deviant of the highest order in less time than it took most men to complete their first alcoholic binge. Worse still, I was no longer ashamed of it. I owned my perversions, wore them proudly like an expensive suit made of butt plugs. When my neighbor, the old widow Masters, saw me walking my escorts out of the house early the next morning, I smiled and waved at her. Most men, upon losing their wife to illness late in life, would buy a dog, plant a garden, participate in social mixers. I fucked prostitutes in the ass. Still, as out of control as my obsession had become, I was not without morality. The only line I refused to cross sexually was with animals and children. The innocent need not suffer for my sins. Through all of this, my love affair with pornography had not ended. I still watched fuck movies more times per day than I ate or shit. My favorite porno fetish, after nearly 2 months of this decadent, lascivious lifestyle, turned out to be the gangbang. There was just something preternatural about all of those rock-hard cocks violating one small woman. Something about one girl's ability to take all of those sticky, white cum shots that turned my crank like nothing else. I was insatiable, and yet the gangbang eluded me in real life. I could hire all the hookers I could ever fuck 10 times over. Susanna's life insurance policy, coupled with our modest lifestyle and frugal spending, had left me with a considerable savings. And yet, I could not just invite my friends or colleagues over for afternoon tea. Oh, by the way, fellas, Janice here is going to take our cocks in all of her holes and then slurp our man seed down with all the enthusiasm of a starving Ethiopian. See you at noon! No, the gangbang would be tricky. I was vaguely aware of clubs which catered to the swinger audience, but it was my rudimentary understanding that single gentlemen were discouraged from attending such events. Besides, as proud as I'd become of my newly awakened sexuality, I did not want to risk my tenure at the college being spotted at such a questionable establishment. My frequent visits to Hottest Topics were already pushing it. Then, one afternoon, while swapping DVDs at said porno shop, the clerk, whom I now knew as Samuel, dropped his magazine and called out to me by name when I entered the store.
Mr. P!
His face lit up with excitement. Samuel had taken a liking to me over the course of my descent into debauchery. Slowly, over the period of time I'd been visiting the store, I'd opened up to the young man. His dyed, spiky black hair, his ridiculously large-gauged earplugs, his 7 lip rings, and his satanic pentagram t-shirts all added credence to the feeling that my lewd acts and obsessive pornography consumption were abhorrent and taboo. I wanted to feel abhorrent and taboo. Life was so much better when lived this way. So much more flavorful and satisfying. We'd discussed Susanna's death, my former puritanical lifestyle, my newfound hobby of being shit on by prostitutes, even my teaching position at the university. Samuel approved of my second life. He fancied himself a bit of a writer. I'd offered to read some of his work as thanks for helping guide my path toward darkness and depravity. Mostly, I think he was amused by the enthusiastic old pervert patronizing his store several days a week, sometimes twice in the same day, in fact. "Hello, Samuel," I said, returning his smile as I set down the entire catalog of I Gangbang DVDs issues 1 through 37 on the counter.
"Dude, have I got something for you.
I almost called you this afternoon, but I figured you'd wander in here sooner or later." "What is it, son?" I chuckled, always eager to see what new sex toy or movie he'd found for me to play with.
"Well,"
he said, writing me up a store credit for my returned movies.
"You're not going to believe this, but remember our conversation yesterday about how hard it would be to get in on an actual gangbang?"
I'd vented my frustrations to him. He was my porno priest, always willing to hear my deepest, darkest sins and desires, always ready to hand out retribution. "Bless you, my son. Say 5 anal bukkakis, 6 barely legal cum sluts, 4 big black buttholes, and all will be forgiven. Samuel was my savior, and finally, appropriately, my damnation. I remember, I said.
Well, after you left, I jumped online and checked Craigslist and several other forums, trying to hunt you down a group of dudes willing to let you get your fuck on, but I couldn't come up with anything. Gangbang dudes are a picky bunch, apparently.
I had no idea what he was talking about, but I got the gist of what he meant. The internet held no interest for me that I could not find in a book or journal. The thought of sitting in front of that artificial glow, squinting and clicking my life away, made my stomach crawl.
But, he said, features lighting up in excitement, then a really, and I mean really creepy little dude came in here and posted this on the All Pervert board.
The pervert board was a bulletin board that hung against a wall in the back of the DVD room. On it, people could post anonymous hookup messages back and forth until they felt comfortable meeting in person. It was populated mostly by messages from men, and most of those men received mostly no response. But this was different. This was an advertisement, a flyer for a party, a gangbang party. It was written in crude handwriting, obviously Xerox copied. It read, "Ever wanted to gangbang a real girl? Now's your chance. Call 555-8765. Under the note was a stick figure girl surrounded by giant cocks with big, smiling, happy faces drawn on them. Obviously, I was interested, but something was off about the flyer. Something that smacked of suspicion. And then there was the smell.
Like fucking cotton candy, eh? Samuel said. He didn't say a word to me. Just tacked up the little flyer and then scurried out of here like he was terrified to be noticed. And after he left, the whole goddamn place reeked of cotton candy. It smelled like a carnival in here. I swear to God, I went home craving funnel cake.
I want to call him, I said, and then added, should I call him? Even though I'd already made up my mind the moment I'd laid eyes on those smiling, happy cocks. Samuel shook his head.
No. Mr. P, I just wanted to show you the fucking thing.
I looked at him and smiled. Oh, fuck. He understood his folly then. Understood perfectly well that he could have told me he'd seen the man positively identified by the FBI on the 6 o'clock news of serial murdering perverted old school teachers, and it wouldn't have softened the steel boner in my pants in that moment. My happy, smiling steel boner.
Jesus, just be careful, Mr. P. You have no idea what kind of crazy shit you're about to get yourself into.
Had I only listened to his warning. Had I only heeded that simple bit of advice. But of course, I did not.
All right, and we're back.
We're back.
So.
He found some number.
Cotton candy, part one. Poor Mr. Tillinghast. So the girls in his classroom find a note from him and start reading out loud. And it becomes a first-person narrative. Mm. That voice was really hard to maintain over the course of this story, especially when I had to go from Mr. P to two or three other... But we haven't gotten to the gang yet. We haven't gotten to the gang of the bang yet. So this first part was relatively easy. We kind of breezed through the first 30 or 45 minutes of this because it was basically... Pillinghast.
The only problems you had when we were recording really was the girls' voices at the beginning.
Yep.
And then once we switched...
The regular narrator to the girls' voices to Mr. P was kind of a hard transition.
Well, it's a slow transition while you're...
Then there's a big, long period right here where it's just Mr. P talking about his wife dying, talking about awakening his sexual urges and...
Really, he's a guy in the porn.
Yeah, store. Well, we talked about that on the last podcast we did, the Reading the Monsters podcast. We aired this before. We had a whole nother podcast for new listeners. We did a whole nother podcast for about 6 months back in 2012, and we aired a couple of these. We've done brand new stuff nobody's ever heard. Last month, Barbarian Month, yes. Brand new story.
It's just it's not even published
yet. Jorek and the Swamp Phantoms Vic hasn't been published in print yet, and it's been aired on the podcast. But we do have some of these throwbacks, like Cotton Candy, that were from the previous incarnation of this show called Reading the Monsters. And we talked about on that show that the inspiration for this story and the inspiration for a lot of what happens in it is that I managed a porn shop for 6 years. And I actually wrote myself as a character in this story, Mr. Pillinghast goes to a porn shop, meets a guy that works behind the counter that he befriends, and gets comfortable enough with to talk about his perversions and everything, and I wrote myself as that character.
Yeah, and during a really rough recording of this, when I was going to do the actual voice work, I did the Kevin Strange.
So I promised that that after the break we would get into the origins of cotton candy. And cotton candy came from the Strange Sex Anthology, which was the very first release from Strange House Books, which was the publishing company that I decided to use. I was actually using Strange House as when I was making movies, I couldn't just say Kevin Strange did everything. Kevin Strange wrote it, directed it, edited it, starred in it, all this stuff. So I would have the special effects. If you watch my movies, it would be Strange House FX is what I would credit the special effects. And the special effects ain't nothing special about them special effects in my movies. They're really fucking bad. But that's where the, I don't think anybody knows that. I don't think I've ever talked about that, where the Strange House name came from. That came from, it's obviously a play on Arkham House, which was August Derleth's publishing house that he created after H.P. Lovecraft's death to publish for the first time outside of Weird Tales magazine, to publish H.P. Lovecraft's work as standalone fiction. Not a lot of people don't know that. Lovecraft only had one or two things actually published outside of magazines in his own collections. I want to say it was one. He had one book that had come out in his lifetime. He was dead before any of the books that, and there's hundreds if not thousands of books that have now been published with his name on it. But August Derleth created, Arkham was the name of the town, the fictional town that H.P. Lovecraft set his Miskatonic University, where the Necronomicon was stored. That was in Arkham, Massachusetts. So August Derleth called the publishing house Arkham House. So I called, as an homage to that, I called my publishing house Strange House. And that's the origin of that. And so, coming off of movies and knowing I wanted to do fiction, I wanted to make a big splash right out of the gate. I've got a big ego. I had already been fairly successful on the independent scene. I had been screened at many film festivals and had even won an award for my film Nixon and Hogan Smoke Christmas. The best film to smoke to, 2009 or 2010, I don't remember, from the Oklahoma Underground Film Festival. So I wanted to come correct. I didn't want to just pussy out some short fiction and novels and stuff and have nobody even know that I existed. And it was a tough sell because my movies are such like sophomoric, stoner, pervert humor. And my fan base, I'm not saying that they can't read, but I'm saying that nobody was asking me to write books. Let's just put it that way. When I said I'm retiring from filmmaking, everybody went, "What? No! No!" Everybody was so fucking mad at me. And I mean, by everybody,
they're movie centric. I met a lot of the straight or the hack movie films people when we've been out on the road.
Yeah.
They're all about independent movies and kind of.
They're just not readers.
Yeah.
They're just not.
Everybody's got their thing.
Yeah, they're not big readers. So I felt like I was under a lot of pressure to do something that would have. I wanted to be able to somehow create a bridge between my film fans and creating a whole new fan base for my fiction. And I felt like the best bridge I could make, since my films were all sex comedies, horror sex comedies, like sex comedies with gore in them, basically. And monsters, that the best bridge I could build between film and literary was a sex bridge. And so I wanted to, and I didn't want it to just be me by myself. The idea was I was going to build Strange House into a record label type thing, where I was going to be the main. Everybody already knew who I was out on the road. This is Kevin Strange. Shug all Knight, know who I am. So the Shug Knight of this record label or, you know, publishing house. And that I would put my name on it real big, and then I would put on other authors with me that would sort of get a rub off of my name out there on the road. And so the first thing I wanted to release was an anthology collection. And people do that with films. They release little anthology films that have a bunch of different filmmakers that one production house will put out an anthology of. There's a guy that does some short collections he has have 7, 8, 9, 10 little short films that are only like 4 or 5 minutes long.
The Collective guy.
Yeah, The Collective is what he calls the collection of films that he puts out.
Brian Williams gave me a copy of The Collective.
Yeah, and our buddy Brian Williams was part of that, part of, I think it's number 6 that he was on. So it was kind of, I wanted to do something similar to that, where I just got a bunch of authors together that would write weird shit, and then I would have the longest. I would write a novella, and then around that novella would be short stories. So I would be able to go out on the road and say, okay, fans, listen, I know, you don't want me to make another movie. I understand that. But I wrote a book instead. I've got the longest thing in this. I've got the novella. And then a bunch of short stories from other guys that have written, and gals, that have written fucked up shit. And I told everybody, write the most depraved, extreme, offensive stuff you can think of, because that's what my fans know me from. So I couldn't think of a more shocking, right in your face, this is what it is, because I have movies like Cockhammer, Dead Shit, Colonel Kill Motherfuckers. I'm never one to shy away from a shocking, provocative title. So Strange Sex was, to me, a badass title that would pop right off the page and sell this fucking book and sell me to the audience as a writer instead of a filmmaker. This weird transition, this pivot in artistic nature.
I know when you put this out on Facebook, I even tried my hand. I didn't get it done in time by any means, but I even tried to write a story.
Yeah, I put a call out for submissions. Never done this before, but give us the craziest stuff you have. And I talked about this on the other podcast incarnation we did back in 2012, that for everything we would do later on, and all the way we would learn and grow, I was so naive going into this. I think out of 15 submissions, we published 14 stories. I mean,
I wish I got mine done.
We got next to nothing. Because there are actual websites you can submit calls for submissions to that email that list out to thousands of writers. And all I did was send this out to my Facebook fan, and all my Facebook fans were Hack Movies fans and horror convention people. That's all my Facebook was at the time. So I sent this out, and we barely got any fucking responses for it. First of all, I'm a brand new press. Nobody's ever heard of me before. Nobody knows shit about me from the literary world. They didn't have any fucking idea who I am. I'm going, I'm award-winning filmmaker Kevin Strange. And they went, you can suck a fucking dick. We don't know who you are. So nobody, and come to find out later in retrospect, these cunty-ass writing community motherfuckers immediately assume anybody that comes out on the publishing scene is just trying to steal money from them.
Oh, yeah.
Is this some fraud artist that's going to fucking rip off these poor authors that just didn't know any better? I had no idea at the time. Like I said, I was trying to build something like a record label. Hey, you got a story, I'll put it in this book, and hopefully we'll all get fucking rub off of it. And so I put this book together. And the cover of the book is the story, Cotton Candy. Now, I have a sort of internet famous friend who comes from the Juggalo community. She's very famous in the Juggalo community, but she's also just sort of internet famous. She built her fan base off of LiveJournal, if you remember what that is.
Yeah.
LiveJournal was a social networking site way before social networking sites existed. And she goes by the name of Triple Six. And she was kind enough. I mean, this girl is, like, when I say internet famous, I mean tens of thousands of people follow.
I was utterly shocked because I know her through you. And, you know, I didn't realize how internet famous she was. And then I think it was Instagram or one of the social media sites, you know, friend request her. She, you know, came back with it. And then I looked at it. I was like, holy shit. She's like internet famous. That's crazy.
Yeah. So luckily, she's a cool motherfucker. And I reached out to her when I was making movies and said, you know, she's got this badass look, this giant dreadlocks. Really unique look. It's not unique anymore because since she became internet famous, she's one of the original goth girls that made those fuzzy boots famous.
The fuzzy boots and the fake dread light or like springy things.
She's one of the very first girls that had that look. And there are thousands of girls with that look now. You can't throw a rock at a concert without seeing fake dreads and fuzzy boots.
Well, I can remember. I mean, that's a really popular look in the Juggalo community. I can remember seeing her, and then like the next show, there was like four different girls.
Well, I would say without a shadow of a doubt, she is the only reason that any of the girls in the Juggalo community dress like that. They're literally emulating her. So anyway, we're all from St. Louis. And since she happens to be from St. Louis, she'd always been cool, and we actually, back when Yahoo Messenger was a thing, before there was social media, you just chatted with your friends on instant messenger services. She and I were friends on Yahoo Messenger, and we would just talk. We would chat back and forth. She would always answer me, even though I'm sure she got dozens of fucking messages an hour from crazy teenage girls that were into her. And I asked her one time, I was like, you got such a cool look and everything. Do you want to be a villain in a movie? And she said, yeah, she would do it. So she ended up being Sarsaparilla the Weed Witch in Nixon and Hogan Smoke Christmas, the movie that won the award at the Tulsa, Oklahoma Underground Film Festival. And she had a ton of fun doing it. I had a ton of fun shooting her. And she was always like, you know, anything else you want to do, anything else you want to do. And so I asked, I was going through her pictures, or she posted a picture, makes it sound less creepy. She posted a picture on social media years later, and she was wearing one of those fuzzy hats with eyeballs. And they like hang down, and it kind of looks like there's a monster on their head.
Yeah.
And it inspired this whole story, Cotton Candy. That picture of her, I thought, well, what if a group of furries got together to gangbang this girl this is a spoiler alert for this story, but I sort of give this away when I pitch the story, I took the inspiration from this day glow fuzzy hat with googly eyes on it, and I remembered back to a book I read in fifth grade, actually in the middle school library. They had a book on witchcraft, and one of the chapters was lycanthropy. And it was all the different ways you could transform yourself into a werewolf. And one of the ways was called skinwalking. Are you familiar with the Native American skinwalking? American, yeah. So what they do is they salve up themselves with a concoction, and they actually slip the skin of an animal over their naked body under the light of a full moon, and in combination with this elixir that they've covered themselves with and the magic of the moon, they transform into the creature whose skin they're wearing, and they call them skinwalkers. And so I thought back to the skinwalking myth from that witchcraft book. Now you tell me why there was a witchcraft. This was the late 1980s, early 1990s. There was a straight up, honest to God, no bullshit witchcraft book in a middle school library. For all you motherfuckers who have never been to libraries, too young to know what goodies and little gems and treasures you can find in your local library. Libraries used to be a place you could go where there were no holds barred. They didn't sell you Hustler magazine, but there was so much crazy, explicit, absolutely bonkers shit that kids should have no access to.
And I think it's all because of librarians like we met at Horror.
Angie the Librarian. Yeah. Right? If you're listening to this, Angie the Librarian, I checked out a witchcraft book in fifth grade, and it inspired a gangbang story. So I thought back to the skinwalker myth, and then I thought of 666's googly-eyed fuzzy hat, and I was like, what if the googly-eyed fuzzy hat was a skinwalker thing, and these furries dressed up in their Dayglow bear costumes and rabbit costumes and all this, and under the light of the full moon, transmogrified into these creatures. And so that's where Cotton Candy was born, and we contacted a god. I still love him to death, and he's becoming very successful at what he does. The only reason I say god is because we spent a lot of money. I had no idea how much covers cost in the small press fiction world, and I had no idea what the return on a release was. In other words, when you put a book out, how much money you're expected to get back, how many copies you're going to sell, yeah, and how much profit you're going to make on those copies versus how much money you spend on the editing, on how much money you pay to the authors in an anthology, and how much you pay for the cover art. Mm-hmm. To say that we lost our motherfucking ass on this book would be an understatement, because the cover art alone, I contacted this guy, and it's not the other way around. I don't remember where I found his name's Seamus Bale, and he's a New York City based Native American comic book illustrator, and his claim to fame more recently is he illustrated a comic book, a graphic novel for John Leguizamo, and it got huge press all over the world for this graphic novel, and John Leguizamo went on a signing tour for this graphic novel, and Seamus Bale was all the art. He did 100% of the art. He also did, I want to say, not the covers and not the interior illustration, he did the promo art for the Watchmen relaunch. You remember they did a Watchmen after Watchmen, I think they called it?
It was a series of comic books, wasn't it?
Well, there was the Watchmen, and then there's...
No, I'm saying the after the Watchmen. They were at the comic book shop I go to. They
yeah.
were, like, stories, background stories.
Background stories on the Watchmen. Yeah. I just actually looked over there. You got the Watchmen comic book. Yeah. So I was like, I thought Jeremy knew what the Watchmen was.
Yeah,
So they did, years later, they did another, and Alan Moore isn't involved in it, but they did a whole other series. And he didn't work on the... Seamus didn't work on the art for the comics. He worked on the promo art for the ads.
Yeah.
The ad art to promote the Watchmen series. So he's a legit comic book artist. This dude is legit as fuck. And I want to say, no. It did go this way. Because there's a filmmaker named... what the fuck is his name now? Now I can't think of his name. His name's... Mills. Dustin Mills.
Okay.
There's a filmmaker named Dustin Mills who I met at a convention selling Strange Sex. And he came up to me and was like, I bought all your movies years ago. You probably don't remember me. I was like, no, I meet hundreds of people. I sign, you know how it was at the show. I'm drunk signing, you know, you're just shoving books in my hands. I'm signing, I'm trying as hard as I can to talk to these people, but I don't remember people from show to show. And that's not an insult to those people. It's just I sign so much stuff. You really need to connect with me for me to remember who the fuck you are. And I'll remember your face.
To be fair, you do it after a little bit of like, I was this show, this is what I bought. You do start to remember a little bit of a good majority of them, but there's no way you could remember
everybody. I usually remember faces, but I don't remember names or connect to... And then when they start telling me, we met here, you did that, I'm not like, oh, absolutely, okay, I remember you. So this Dustin Mills character comes up to me at a show and tells me, I bought all your movies and your commentaries and behind the scenes were my film school. And that's how I learned to make movies. I learned to make movies from... the Hack movies, from Kevin Strange movies. And I was like, oh, that's fucking cool, man. And then he showed me one of his movies, and I was like, motherfucker, that cover is... That's how I found Seamus.
Oh.
To do the Strange Sex cover. So it's like this weird... And I told you there's been synchronicity before. We talked about the Loch Ness thing, and I told you that was like the most bizarre synchronicity.
Yeah.
But it was, you know, that Dustin Mills thing was a whole other thing. Like, without my movies, he would have never became a filmmaker, and he never would have hired Seamus to do the cover that I saw that caused me to hire Seamus to do my first book cover. It's this weird cross synchronicity.
Well, it's hard to get closer than Loch Ness Lay. That's all I'm going to start referring to her as, Loch Ness Lay.
Did I tell that story about Dustin Mills on the...
Oh, no. I don't know about the original one, Reading the Monsters.
So... I contacted Seamus. I was like, here's the story. And here's the, I sent him pictures of 666 and said, I want her to have this hat on with googly eyes, you know, and I showed her, she wears fuzzy boots and, sexy ass fucking, what do they call that? The fucking
garters.
Yeah. Whatever.
The sand's up there.
So I showed him everything, told him what I wanted, and he came back with the quote. I'm not going to talk prices. I'm not going to say how much he charged me, but he charged me a lot.
As and their former businessman, a shitload would cover it.
Let's say I could have paid for what I pay now, what I know now these books go for fairly because of the return on the investments you get fairly. I could have probably paid for 7 or 8 covers.
Yeah.
With the money that we spent.
A shitload.
Just on this cover. And that is not an insult to Seamus. He's worth every fucking penny. He was only charging me what he would charge as a comic book illustrator. The only problem was he was already way out of my fucking league before I ever met him. And so he did a beautiful fucking cover. A beautiful cover for us. So not to be deterred, I immediately bought another cover for him. And he also did the Murder Stories for Your Brain piece cover. And I paid him exactly the same. So my first couple of books, I could have paid for like a dozen book covers.
With what I paid Seamus. Entire first year's earnings from...
The entire first year's earnings just went to Seamus for 2 book covers. And I love him. Still friends with him to this day. Still rooting for him. Still celebrating his successes and all the wonderful stuff that he does. Never bought another book cover from him. Can't afford it. I wish I was successful enough now that I could still be buying Seamus covers, but I would have been dead broke years ago if I would have kept buying...
Suck your dick for a cover.
Yeah, if I would have kept buying Seamus covers. So Cotton Candy went in the Strange Sex Anthology with the Seamus cover art. That was the very first book Strange House released, and we sold a fuckload of copies of that book. Not enough to cover the cost of the fucking cover and everything else and all the authors that we paid and everything else that went into it. But the first few conventions we went to, man, we sold the fuck out.
And no matter the first few, I didn't go to the first few with you. I was not the business manager at that time.
And I had to bring your ass on as a business manager because I couldn't figure out how to make money. I was spending so much fucking money on book covers.
I realized I was like, these covers. Bro. You told me, I was like, holy shit.
Bro, help us make money. But we can't do this.
But even, all the way through the rest of the ones we worked together, I mean, that was a popular one. It drew the attention.
Oh, yeah.
Because Seamus makes pretty grails.
I mean, oh, yeah. Absolutely.
And you can definitely tell it's 666. The people that know her, it automatically rings of her.
I have girls that tell me things like, why does she get a book cover? And I don't. I'm like, honey, just wait. I'll get you on a cover.
We can talk some big ass.
Absolutely. So, that's the story. The origin of Strange Sex, the origin of Cotton Candy. Is there anything, any other questions you had, Jeremy, as a fan, about that first anthology or anything from that era?
Not anything that wouldn't be a spoiler. Maybe on later episodes, I don't want to spoil any of the future for the non-Patreons out there. But yeah, there's a question or two from
the story itself.
Yeah,
we'll get into the
of where influences was. But at this point now, I know who this is. This is you and all your friends. If we were in a similar situation, married for that long, and then had the rest of us as friends as soon as we were not married anymore, we would be fairly similar to old Mr. P.
Old Mr. Pillinghast.
Yeah.
All right, gang. So that'll do it for this episode of Reading to Strangers. Be sure to come back next week for part 2.
Yep.
Of Cotton Candy, where Mr. Pillinghast calls the number on the flyer and meets up with the gangbang organizer. Dun dun dun. Till next week, gang. Remember,
keep reading, bitches.
All music featured on the Reading to Strangers podcast provided by Kevin MacLeod at Incompetech.com. Licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 3.0. http://creativecommons.org/license/by/3.0/.